Okay, well, I'm. Hello, I'm Harry. Thank you for still being here at the end of a very long day. I have a European work ethic. I'd have knocked off a long time ago if Lorette wasn't in charge. I've been asked to talk about challenges on the road ahead, hence the picture. And it seems to me we've got a lot of challenges. But I'm an optimist, and I think we can overcome most of these challenges. We've had a lot of discussions today about understanding what's going on in one form or another. How do we actually know what's happening? Do the models really reflect it? If we do know what's happening, how do we know what to do? How do we know when to do it? How to do it? How do we build the evidence base? Oh, thank you so much. In the real world, I think it's very important that we build a theoretical evidence base, but we need to understand what that means in the real world. How do we collaborate across different countries, across different sectors? We all have different worldviews. We come at this, apologies for the German, but I think the word Weltanschauung is a really useful word in this context to think about the perspectives that we bring to this, the fact that some of us are modellers and some of us are statisticians. We need to think about that and build on it as an approach that allows us to think about our different perspectives. I was reading on the plane, I read a piece from the New Yorker about the financial crisis by a guy called John Lanchester, and I've underlined a few quotes in it. But he quotes from a book by Richard Posner, and Posner says, "The very existence of warring schools within a field is a clue that the field is weak, however brilliant its practitioners." And he also says, "A common mistake of very smart people is to assume that other people's minds work in the same way that theirs do." And I certainly have some friends to whom that applies. And Lorette said at the very beginning of the day, how do we move from what to how? How do we turn knowledge into action, really? And I wonder if any of you have seen this. It's a fabulous classification from Borges, who quotes, I mean, I think he made it all up, but he pretended that this was translated from an ancient Chinese encyclopedia, and he divided animals into 14 categories. And this makes sense to someone, somewhere, I guess. My favourite is N. I mean, animals that from a long way off look like flies. I mean, other than flies, what is that? But I think the point of this, and actually if you look this thing up online, there's a whole literature about this bizarre taxonomy. I think Foucault went on about it at length in terms of our perceptions of reality and our perceptions of the world around us and the way in which we categorize things. And I think we sometimes need to step back from the way we view the world ourselves and think about how others may, whether those people are real people, you know, the stakeholders that we need to engage with, or whether they're other people, other researchers with a different perspective. So when we want to know what's going on, how do we, just in terms of something as simple as BMI, how do we define BMI? What does it mean in people from different ethnic groups? How do we deal with measurement errors? How do we deal with selection bias? How do we, when you're looking at it in children, what do we use as a reference population? The closer you, I mean, it's this whole thing is fractal. The closer you look, the more problems you see. I mean, I've been doing a lot of work on BMI in my day job back home. BMI is the only thing I get hate mail for, generally. I mean, it's extraordinary, but, you know, it's just a tool. But the closer you look at it, the more you realize that it's perhaps not quite a universal tool. But that's fine. It's a good enough tool in the right circumstances. But it flags up, someone said just now, this business of the difference between facts and values, the concept of cognitive relativism. I mean, I think a lot of us, myself included much of the time, tend to be very positivist about this, very, very objective. And actually, the real world isn't always quite as objective as we'd like to think it is. And there was a child psychologist in the 60s, a guy called Donald Winnicott, who came up with this concept of a good enough parent. It's a concept I'm quite pleased with, actually, because it's as much as I can aspire to. But I think the idea of good enough data, good enough evidence, is a really important one for us to grasp. We must not let the perfect be the enemy, or the excellent be the enemy of the good. You know, we sometimes just need to take a step back again and think, okay, is what we've got good enough? Is it good enough to act, most importantly? So you've seen all this. Yes. Took me hours to work out how to do this. And here's a less sexy one. Because I just wanted to let you know, and I mentioned, I think, this last year, for those of you who are here, that a colleague of mine has, in fact, a very old friend of mine, who happens to be, or fancies himself anyway, as an expert in system modelling, did some work for us revisiting the Foresight map with a much more purist system approach. He's quite critical of the Foresight map. He says, they haven't got the right balancing loops, the right reinforcing loops. It's, you know, he says from a purist perspective, he doesn't like it. We have big arguments. He thinks it's all much too simple. He thinks that the problem is simple and the map overcomplicates it. I think it's still quite a complicated problem. Anyway, I've just got a little smattering here. He's split it up into 10 different maps. It to some extent, tracks the change over time. So this is man as an animal. I think one of the system talks we had earlier showed, I think someone had drawn, what was it, rabbits and vultures or something. Well, this is kind of the same thing for humans. But, you know, he's got a sub-map that places capitalism at the centre of it. The desire to substitute capital for labour and what that does for the amount of energy people expend in their working lives. oops. Oil originally in place. And as we've heard from the International Energy Authority whistleblower recently, there may be rather less than we've been led to believe. But what does peak oil do to the price of fuel, to the cost of food as a result, to the amount of energy we expend moving around? And I think this slightly more detailed approach, focusing on certain areas, can help us admittedly only to understand what's going on, but also perhaps to help us to see ways in which we might intervene. This is one of my favourite slides, because it's very simple, and it was really easy to draw. The great thing about obesity
is that we see it here.
So there's lots to do. And my view is that when you don't really know what the evidence is, when you've got uncertainty,
it's fine to be speculative. It's good to be speculative. If you think it makes sense to do something, have a punt on it. Give it a go.
But evaluate it. Research it. Learn from it.
And feed your learning from here into this chart, into this line. Because what's inexcusable is to find ourselves 10 years down the line with the speculative stuff still up here and the evidence-based stuff still down here. And I mean, I really think that's inexcusable.
Now, we're not necessarily responsible for that. It's the low priority afforded to evaluation. The reality of research and evaluation when money is constrained. But I think, as anyone who's working in this field, we have a duty to do our best to try and shift from one line to the other. But of course, if we are over on this side, good old Ludwig told us that we probably can't really say anything about what's going on. This is another one I use with my children. Here's the map again. And I just want to give a little anecdotal story about me with my little rather nerdy folding bicycle that I take on the train, carry it like this, ride it along, take it on the train with me when I go to London. So over on the right-hand side of the map, we've got physical activity. So that's me riding my bike. Up the top, we've got psychology and social pressures. So that's people saying, here, have a biscuit. Over on the food and nutrition side, I eat the biscuit. Whoops, what's happened to the energy balance? So did the cycling infrastructure intervention work? If you only look on that side, it probably did. Did the social marketing intervention work? Looks like it probably didn't, but perhaps they were going to offer me muffins. So the biscuit was better than it could have been. So maybe the social marketing intervention did work. What about the traffic light labelling on those biscuits that I so boldly ignored as I scoffed them? You know, what happened there? How do we answer these questions? How do we measure these interactions? And these are just the simple ones. You know, I'm giving you a stupid, banal example. Can we measure them? How do we do it? What do we do about this difference between measuring things in individuals and scaling up, or measuring things at population level? If you've got 30 different small effect sizes, you know, I lose 18 calories by cycling and I gain 22 from some biscuit crumbs. How do you balance that up? What about the compensatory behaviours, the fact that I've earned the biscuit? So I eat, perhaps I cycle a bit harder on the way back because I feel guilty. How do we measure that? How do we deal with the flows and the feedback loops? How do we model this? And in a biomedical research paradigm that tends to focus
here, or here, or here, or here,
and really finds it very hard to answer questions that involve all of those at the same time. How do we research them? How do we come up with these answers? And I'm really taken, there's a book by a woman called Gillian Tett, who's the assistant editor of the Financial Times. She's written a book called Fool's Gold about the financial crisis. Very well-respected book, very well-respected journalist. She's a financial journalist, but she's got a PhD in anthropology. And she talks about the social silences, so the gaps between the things that we know. How do we find out about them? We all tend to focus, we want to focus on the things that we know about. We pretend the things we don't know about aren't there. But I think we've got a lot to learn from people like Gillian Tett. And these novel perspectives on our own domains, our own different ways of looking at things. And I just wanted to give you a few examples now of some things that we've done in the Obesity Observatory to support the development of practice-based evidence, to try and shift us from the speculative to the evidence-based lines on that chart. So there's a lot of money being put into weight management interventions in England, things like MEND and Carnegie, this kind of thing that I'm sure you'll have heard of. And they're generally, I think, very good interventions, but there's rather little evaluation of them taking place. And my view was that we should just reduce, you know, lower the barriers to entry for evaluation. We should reduce the thresholds, make it easy for people. And one of the things that a national organisation can do is get some economies of scale. So we put a lot of work, did a huge amount of consulting and engagement with people to try and work out what was a sensible minimum data set as a core set of criteria to be able to drive a good enough evaluation. And we had evaluation academic experts on one side saying, oh, no, you've got to fill out a book 400 pages long. No, you've got to do that. And then practitioners on the other side saying, oh, God, do we really have to evaluate? Is there one question we can ask just to find out whether this works or not? And, you know, of course, the reality is you've got to be somewhere in the middle. And there is no perfect middle ground. We just have to find it. So I'm pleased to say we're evaluating our evaluation framework. We realised quite late in the day we had to do that. So what we've done is we've got some very simple guidance, straightforward guidance. If you're an evaluation expert, you don't need to read the first 20 pages of this. But if you're not, it might be helpful. We've then got 2 pages of core, essential and desirable criteria. Essential on the left, desirable on the right. You don't need to read them, don't worry. It's the principle of identifying a problem and trying to reduce the challenges to meeting that problem. In this case, a professional problem of a lack of evaluation. We've done a whole lot of other things, like we're trying to embed the requirement to evaluate into any commissioning of these kinds of interventions using public money. My view is if you spend public money on something that you don't have certainty about whether or not it works, you have to evaluate it and learn if that's good use of public money. And so we're trying to do that as well. And we'll see how it goes. But it's been well received so far. And I have 2 principles that I apply here, of which the former is, I think, the less important. I think it's really important that when we do this kind of thing, we learn from success. But even more importantly, I think it's really important that we celebrate failure. When something doesn't work, that's a success. And to know that is a success as well. and to own up to it and to be able to say, okay, this doesn't work, we're going to stop spending money on it, you need to be really brave to do that. And I really push this as hard as I can, because I think this is, within the practitioner culture, a really important one to get on board. And, of course, things are looking up. I did this on a Saturday morning. I searched through PubMed, just for the word obesity, and I just counted the number of hits from 1980 to 2008. So whether or not that's a true measure of evidence, there's something going on to suggest that there is some light at the end of the tunnel. Now, Loretta's also asked me to try going from a tunnel to a bridge, bridge across to tomorrow and think about ways in which we might turn the debate that we've had today into practical steps. And I just wanted to talk a bit about some ideas about knowledge systems and ways of getting some of these approaches into practice. So these blobs, they can represent intervention components. Each colour could be a different component of an intervention, or it could be core data. So it could be that the blue block boxes are the core data from our standard evaluation framework in a load of different projects, and the different colours represent more data that people want to collect. It doesn't really matter. The point is that if people are left to their own devices and they don't have any clear mechanism for communicating, they'll have a free-for-all. And some of them will talk. They've got friends. And they'll talk to Bob down the road or Susan round the corner and, you know, have a chat, and they'll collaborate, and they'll get some increased learning. But it could be better. Or you could be very Soviet about it, and you could say, okay, this is how we're going to manage the process. We want a global knowledge system here. Loretta is going to tell us how to do it. There will be a managed process from a nerve center somewhere in this building. It says, okay, this is what you do. We don't want any colored blobs unless they're blue. They will all be like that in a row. We will collate them. We'll collate the outputs, and we will get the results. So that's control. It has its place, perhaps not here. Or we can take a lighter touch and create by consulting with people, by talking to them, by finding out what's going on. By being democratic, we can create some standards. We can look at the common ground that people have already and see if we can create some standards, see if we can find some tools that will help people to work together. And those people, like the others, will also collaborate. And if they've got a common core of work, of research approaches, of data set, it makes it easier for them to do that. They can then add on their other coloured boxes, whether that's more data or different research approaches, and they can share that information and build on those synergies. And what you then get, I think, is much more powerful results, because they're shared and they're based on a common understanding and agreement and a common approach. And you don't just get the core results, you get the results all around the edge. And it seems to me that has the potential for being a real, you know, I'm stylizing this a bit, but I think that has the potential for a real win-win situation. And what we're really talking about is turning from data into knowledge, really increasing our understanding of what's going on in as efficient and productive and democratic a way as possible. And I just wanted to give an example of something that happened in England over the last few years. We've had investment in, lots of different types of investment, but this one's about six cycling development towns, CDTs. And I haven't bothered to name them all, because I couldn't remember, but I've numbered them from one to six. And when the cycling development towns were announced, I realised that no one had done any baseline physical, put any physical. There was a lot of investment from the Department for Transport. It was supposed to match Northern European levels of investment in cycling in six towns within England. No one had put any baseline physical activity monitoring in. So I spent 2 weeks doing nothing but put together a big bid, which had, I think, six towns, 12 control towns. Anyway, in the end, there was a budget freeze, and we couldn't get the controls. But in order to get big enough numbers to be able to say something, we just went with the towns themselves, took some baseline physical activity measures. We measured something like 10,000 or 12,000 people. and thought we'd deal with the control issue later. So we had some very focused data from a baseline physical activity survey in 2006 from six towns. That was repeated 2008, 2009, almost a year ago. And we then realised that we had to do something to make up for these missing controls. So what we did, and actually it's done over more than six towns because we matched groups of towns, but there's a national survey called the Sport England Active People Survey, and we were able to match towns and look at levels of physical activity within those towns across two Sport England surveys, 2005-06, 2007-08. So what you have here is the green ones at the top, which are very focused local surveys, the purplish one at the bottom, which is from a national surveillance program. They were never intended to be compared, but by modeling the data carefully, we were able to generate meaningful comparisons and get knowledge in the middle. And this isn't the best slide, but in fact there are much better slides than this, because in some of them you can see that there was actually a significant increase in cycling and overall levels of physical activity within the cycling development towns. And we wouldn't have been able to show that otherwise, except against secular trends and so on, but not in as robust and meaningful a way as we were able to. So, of course, having done that, we could then feed in other types of data into this kind of model. So we could put in socioeconomic data. We could put in NCMP's, the National Child Measurement Programme, our child surveillance, obesity surveillance programme. We put in a whole load of other data into this kind of model. So what we're trying to do here is match up locally collected data, national surveillance data, and data from different places. But because they're done in a relatively compatible way, we can match them up and make comparisons. So we do a lot of work on the National Child Measurement Programme, which I helped to set up 3 or 4 years ago. And someone mentioned earlier this business of I can't remember exactly what it was you said, but it was looking for the places that were different. So the kind of thing you can do when you're measuring 950,000 children every year is look at predicted levels of obesity based on things like socioeconomic status and ethnicity and particular measurement factors, and then look at what the real prevalence of obesity is in that local area and spot places that are particularly high or unexpectedly low, because there's likely to be something interesting going on in those places. And here's another example of putting together data from different sources to try and find out something new. This is just another plug for the point about centralised, democratically put together tools on behalf of people. You're not telling them, we're not forcing them to use them, but we're saying, if you want to do analysis of the child measurement programme, here's some simple guidance so that everyone in the country can do it in such a way that the denominators are compatible and comparable. We've put tools on our website that anyone can use to drill down to their local area and pull out a whole load of data. So I think this approach of central coordination, but being responsive to the needs and demands of the people distributed around and working with them, it seems to me, well, and I would say it because it's what I do, but it seems to me that it's a sensible approach. Excuse me. But, of course, some much cleverer people have got there first. Hans Rosling, who's a professor at the Karolinska Institute, developed Gapminder. I don't know if any of you have seen this tool. I didn't dare try and set it up. And I'm not normally a risk-averse person, but when it comes to PowerPoint, I'm an extremely risk-averse person. So I wasn't going to try and run a live Gapminder thing in here. But this is a technology that allows really interesting and, I think, very effective demonstration of statistics over time or in other domains. And good old Hans Rosling could have made a killing out of this, but he's just made the approach open source, and in fact there's now a Google gadget. So you can set up a spreadsheet. In fact, I tried to do it earlier and I failed because I'm useless with numbers. But you can set up a spreadsheet in Google Documents and build your own Gapminder chart. And That, I think, is an example of a standard being driven not from above or from below. Excuse me. But because of intellectual authority. This is a good way to do things. And it's free. So all you have to do, if you want to put your data into Gapminder, is format it into the right four-column or five-column system. Put names down one side, dates down the next column, and then your two things of data down the next two columns, you can get your own Gapminder chart. It's very easy. So that standard is being driven by open-source software. So, to come back to our challenges, we need to know what's going on, what to do, when and how to do it. We need to build the evidence base within the real world. We need to work together to turn knowledge into action. And we need to act and learn from that action and close the loop and feed that back in and build this evidence generation loop. So, as far as I'm concerned, obesity is a complex system, a wicked problem. The other technical word is mess. I believe that standards and tools can drive collaboration. I think it's a false dichotomy to say top-down or bottom-up. It's a bit of everything. It's shared. But I also think humility is a powerful tool. Admitting that one doesn't know the answers is, I think, really important, because there are plenty of other people out there coming from their own perspective who have a different approach to oneself, and they may well be right. I think we need to build on the research approaches we have and find new ones to answer some of the more intractable and difficult problems. I think we need to be really promiscuous and omnivorous when it comes to research approaches, gathering data, working out what to do with it, thinking about how to answer these problems, some of which are very easy, but some of which are very tough. And I believe that through this kind of work, we can really lead a new knowledge paradigm, a new way of dealing with public health research, because this is the obvious way in which to start doing it. That's my dad. in my favourite place on earth, which is the top of a mountain in Norway. My father was born in the Solomon Islands, where my grandfather was a doctor. He was, the first Western-educated doctor to be in the Solomon Islands consistently. And he was in a boat, sailed around the islands, looking after people. And my father's name is Kiko. And the Solomon Islands language that they spoke in that part of the islands is called Rovianan. And in the Roviana language, Kiko means little seed, which grows into something great. And he's actually not very tall, so they were wrong. But I think the point here is that we've got little seeds just being germinated, just fertilizing around this room. And he doesn't know I've used this picture, by the way. But I think we have a real opportunity to grow this into something great. And if you think back to the tunnel I showed you at the beginning, you know, we had challenges in the road ahead. And then we had some light at the end of the tunnel. Well, that's what was at the other end. And I think that's what we've got to look forward to. So I think if we can work together, and we can set aside our differences, but while at the same time, I think, creatively exploiting them and making the most of discourse and debate, I think we've got some really fantastic and wonderful opportunities here. Thank you.
You have been wonderful. Why don't we take a few questions, if someone still have a bit of energy, before the cocktail. You did a spectacular job, I think, in coming back to the fact that we need to build on the reality we have now, having a vision of where we want to build this knowledge basis, but capitalizing on both the data, the methods, the people, and so on. I think this I did not tell you what to do and how to do it, but you did exactly what I wanted. Some question?
Just a quick question. You mentioned something that is very interesting and I think very important, but hard to sell, and that is the value of mistakes. That is, I mean, any learning comes from mistakes.
Yeah.
How do you sell that to people you try to sell it to? I mean, what are the ways through which you can communicate that message, or are there, because there is a short-term cost, of course, by getting the mistakes into the process.
I agree. And I think this may be where the financial crisis has come to our assistance, because the biggest mistake to make politically right now is to waste money. And I think there's a really great opportunity to use the current financial, you know, at a time of plenty, it's very, very hard to do that. But as, you know, we've got no money. I mean, who's got money? Which country's got money right now other than Norway, which is there? And that's only through their good fortune and good sense. So I think financial prudence is a really powerful message and tool to use here. It's not the only one. I think as scientists, we certainly all ought to be happy to admit when things haven't worked. There's a long history of people who haven't been, but you know, I'm perfectly happy to admit when something hasn't worked. As a policymaker, it may be harder because one may have made a different kind of political investment in it. But even so, I think there is an opportunity to engage policymakers in this discussion and find ways in which it can be of value to them as well. If it's too difficult, I'll just start coughing.
Yeah, yeah, that's perfect. Well, it is sort of a tough question because it's an attempt to push you to take what you just said into what you heard this afternoon. And did you hear anything about models this afternoon that you're thinking, well, there's a modeling technique that will help us do some of what you're saying here, or that will work well with in the context of trying to bring people together? Did any of those ideas get stimulated as you were listening this afternoon?
I don't think I heard a modeling technique that I didn't think would be useful for that, if that quadruple negative makes sense. I think there's a place for all of these techniques. It would be invidious to single anyone out. I think they all have value. And I guess this, I mean, in some ways it's the same as the communication point before. I think there are some scientific debates that when they spill out into the public arena, confuse people. And as someone who tends to believe in the freedom of information, I feel slightly conflicted about this because I don't want to censor things. But equally, I think in terms of public communication and avoiding confusion, we need to be cautious about how much we expose scientific disagreement and make it appear like, you know, which may be about quite subtle things, and make it appear like no one really agrees and no one knows what's going on. There's a great phrase that I think Freud came up with, which is the narcissism of minor difference. And, people will argue because they've got a slightly different cut of their hat. You know, if that's the only difference between them, they'll focus on their hats or their shoes. And sometimes we get these disagreements when actually the big picture is, you know, these are all useful tools. These are all things that we can use together.
I was thinking a little more specifically about the real world messiness that you talk about and the need to do things in the real world and capture both the positive and the negative responses. Are there modeling ideas that you heard today that will help us with that?
I was particularly taken, I suppose, by the idea of social networks and video games. I thought that was the kind of approach that could be very easily understood by a wider audience, and could explain things or be used to help to understand things in a way that might have a more obvious, wider applicability. I don't know if that's really answered your question, but talk about it later. Yeah.
Good enough answer. That's a good enough answer. Any more questions? Terry?